Welcome to the Deep Further Fact. Good evening, or morning, depending on where you are in the world. So this is the first episode of the Deep Further Fact podcast, and I have to tell you, I'm very excited to be here. I'll get into why in a moment, but before I get into any of the topics that I'm going to raise in this first episode, a few introductory remarks are in order, like, why am I doing this? Where does the name The Deep Further Fact come from? What is this podcast all about? So these are all fair questions. So first and foremost, this is a philosophy podcast with a particular focus. Now, my intellectual interests have always been philosophical, but my formal training is in economics. So for those of you familiar with both, you'll know that economics, like many disciplines, particularly the natural sciences and other social sciences, got their start from or branched off of philosophy. In the case of economics, that happened in the early part of the 18th century. So the Deep Further Fact podcast is inspired by both philosophy and economics, and will straddle both, particularly where they can be found overlapping. And this means we'll be covering moral philosophy, political philosophy, psychology, behavioral econ, cognitive sciences, and related fields. So the idea of creating this podcast has been brewing in my mind for a few years. It was always meant to be a written blog, but about 3 years ago, I discovered audiobooks and podcasts and learned, to my absolute astonishment, that the spoken word entered my brain with no effort. Indeed, I found this medium downright entertaining and in a way that the written page rarely was. And since that discovery, I have consumed probably five times as many books and written works than I would have otherwise, thanks to, the audio version of reading. And my hunch is that many of you are in the same boat and find it easier consuming the audio version of words. So the decision to launch a podcast over a blog became, quite frankly, an easy one. And incidentally, I am also a longtime musician and audio recordist, so there was a connection to the recording arts that I am naturally enthusiastic about. And that made the podcasting format that much easier, because got to showcase some of the music and stuff that you hear on this podcast. So the name of this podcast, The Deep Further Fact, is a reference to a phrase in part three of Derek Parfit's 1984 masterpiece, Reasons and Persons. So Derek Parfit is a philosopher at Oxford University, and I'm comfortable saying that not only is this probably the most important philosophical work produced in the 20th century, it was also the philosophical work that has had the most impact on my thinking. So the topics raised in that book touch on just about everything I think about in terms of philosophy and economics, and I feel a debt to that book and its author. I don't want to go too far here in this introductory podcast and discussion of that book and its ideas. I'm pretty sure I'll probably dedicate at least an entire future podcast to it. But as the sort of preface to that stuff, just know that the phrase, quote, the deep further fact, unquote, pertains to thinking about personal identity. And if you're not used to thinking about that subject, you are in for a wild ride, I promise. Absolutely promise you that when we get to that stuff, for those of you predisposed to philosophical examination, you will find it nothing, if not maddeningly frustrating and exhilarating at the same time. So I'll just leave it at that for now. We shall return to that. So back to philosophy and economics generally. Long ago, I realized I often approached these subjects with questions I don't often hear asked elsewhere. I don't know if I see these subjects in ways fundamentally different than the way others do, but I've always found I had, much to say about them, and if I could be a little bold, have an occasional unique thing to say as well. Now, I say that with some reluctance. It's no secret that the more you learn about a subject, the more you realize how little, if anything, you have to contribute to it. Regardless, my aim here is to ask these questions as a way to approach the subjects in a fresh way, to think about them in ways I assume you don't normally hear or read elsewhere, and let that be the basis for these podcasts. So we'll take a quick little break. When we come back, we'll give some examples. Welcome back from the rock interlude. So as we mentioned, let's get into some examples. Now, I won't explore these fully in this introductory podcast, but I present them here as a small sample of subjects I intend to explore in future podcasts. And the first one is about free will and its intersection with market economics. The idea goes like this. If free will doesn't exist, what does that imply to a popular position held by fiscal conservatives, and especially political libertarians, who claim that all market transactions are free and therefore just? So the idea being pushed against here is the notion that coercion is required to make a market transaction unfree and therefore unjust. And when you dig into the views of those who hold this version of free will, it turns out that basically every market transaction is free and therefore uncoerced and therefore just, except those under the incentives created by governments, whether that's through taxation, regulation, and so on. But when you entertain the idea that free will doesn't exist, you know, and for the traditional philosophical reasons, namely that determinism is true, wouldn't there be a sense in which many market transactions have some degree of, quote, coercion built in by the very nature of human behavior? You know, which is no longer free in this understanding. It seems that when we abandon a commitment to the existence of free will, what replaces it is a fundamental connectedness between human behavior and the rest of reality, which includes other people, and that all of our behavior is fundamentally caused the way everything else in the universe presumably is, and that this obviously would include market transactions, right? So, put more simply, coercion broadly defined is just causation between humans of a certain kind. And, you know, pushing someone physically is coercion, but so is bullying someone with words. You know, causation can come in many different forms. I don't think we should pretend an easy black and white understanding to this. You know, human cognition and behavior is, you know, exceptionally complicated. But it seems clear to me that market transactions are just run-of-the-mill versions of human behavior. And wouldn't be exempt. Indeed, they could be some of the most interconnected. Now, it's possible that coercion occurs through the many domains of human life except in the marketplace, you know, due to some radical serendipity or coincidence, but that would indeed be, you know, radical and difficult to take seriously. You know, one thing that leaves the conversation when we stop supposing that free will exists is that market transactions are just those between autonomous agents whose only interaction is the back and forth talking and negotiating, right? There's a sense in which all human interaction, being the product of causation, becomes a part of the fabric of the causation that occurs on others. So, you know, anyone in a high-stakes sales scenario, you know, indeed even in low-stakes sales scenarios, notices the adrenaline, you know, the accelerated heartbeat, the other physiological effects that occur when the perception of gain and loss is put starkly within view. And, you know, two parties are attempting to come to some agreement, and that's often between two parties who have more or less equal market power. You know, how about the dynamic between an employer and an employee? Or, you know, between a leader and a follower, you know, whether the group is a church, a family, or a social entity of some other kind. You know, probably the most obvious version of the potential for causal action between individuals is, you know, between those in a romantic relationship or within a marriage. You know, it's not fashionable to speak of the causal effects one party has on another because it appears to diminish the possibility for moral responsibility if we start introducing talk of the outside causes of our behavior. But when you look past that, probably no other domain, you know, than that of the romantic relationship demonstrates people having causal effects on each other. And a lot of these dynamics in the language of economics are simply called incentives. And in other social sciences, like sociology, they're called power. But what I'm driving at is that while they can be all of those things, when you entertain that free will doesn't exist, at bottom, these are all just causes. And by their nature, they have their genesis not within ourselves, yet they still result in these various behaviors. And in the case that I'm talking about, market phenomena. So we probably beat that to death. Let's move on to a different example. Now, staying within the free will topic from a completely different angle, you know, the principal evidence that free will exists is a certain internal sense regarding the operations of our mental lives. You know, often unmentioned, though, is that this sense can appear in greater or lesser degrees. You know, in some areas we seem more free, and in others we seem more at the whim of various factors, often our own mental phenomenon. Now, while I do and will argue for the non-existence of free will, I'm not immune to the introspective appearance of its existence. I think I'm exactly like those who believe in its existence, in terms of having an internal sense that what this feels like internally feels like freedom. But as I said, this feeling does not always have the same intensity. For example, lifting my pen on my desk seems to be as free as of an action as I ever get to perform. I can appear to choose or not choose this action with the least amount of hindrance of any kind. You know, scratching an itch can seem a little less free, frankly, and in fact I can find myself scratching an itch before I was even aware I was doing so. And I don't assume that I'm unique in this regard. I, you know, also spent some years being a cigarette smoker, and smoking cigarettes had always seemed something less free yet. You know, that the tug of addiction on my mental life was a real thing, and it didn't feel like the free will, like the lifting of a pen. You know, similar things can be said about various eating disorders, hunger pains, you know, and the rest. I think this is part of what it means to admit, in the case of smoking, that quitting can be so difficult. Calling the act of quitting a simple act of free will misses a lot of what that activity feels like, in addition to the behavior one is trying to correct. Now, this is a part of the free will topic that has always seemed radically under-discussed to me. You know, the question isn't just whether we have it or not. Of course, that is the main question that most people have asked, you know, in the history of this subject. But, you know, I'm coming at this from a different angle, saying that, okay, let's assume we have it. But if we do have it, how much do we have? Do we have it all the conscious time? You know, owing to some considerations already mentioned, that has never seemed even remotely plausible to me. Doesn't it seem closer to true to suggest it comes in degrees? You know, even if I were to grant that we have it, the free will proponent tends not to have thought this part through very much. And when you push on the various areas where it seems like we don't have it or have less of it, he or she invariably feels like they are losing something anyway, as I think they should. So bookmark that thought for a second, and, you know, we'll return to that. So, in the jargon of economics, there is a notion of elasticity, which is understood as the sensitivity or insensitivity to various factors. Usually people are talking about price. So, if you have ever taken a microeconomics course or learned price theory, you'll remember that price elasticity is roughly the slope of a demand or supply curve. That's not exactly correct, but it'll do. So, the price elasticity of demand is the sensitivity that demanders, you know, think consumers, people who buy things, are to the price of whatever it is that they're buying. And so very inelastic demand, which is to say insensitivity to price, seems often associated with areas where free will has less purchase or maybe doesn't have any purchase at all. So classic and obvious examples would be things like gasoline. You know, demand for gasoline is affected relatively little compared to the swings in price gas can experience. You know, so the traditional way to explain that from an economics point of view is to say that the elasticity of demand for gas is, you know, derived straight from the agent's utility function or set of preferences, and those are just a function of his or her psychology. Now, I find that difficult to disagree with, but the psychology as a starting point is very much what I'm interested in here. You know, it seems reasonable to suggest that the same things people feel they need, regardless of the obstacles in their way, are good candidates for things we might also just suggest people don't have free will over or have less over it. But at any rate, the idea here isn't simply to be stuck thinking about free will as a feature of personhood that we either have or we don't have. Now, as I said, I would argue we don't have it and think the arguments in its favor are weak. But regardless, even taking a more relaxed position and allowing for free will's existence, it should be clear that this doesn't commit us to claiming we have it all the time, or even most of the time, or that free will doesn't come in degrees. I think positions like this are far more plausible when taking the existence of free will seriously. So that was a lot about free will. Should probably move on to some fresh subject matter for this first podcast episode. So let's try another topic idea. This one is familiar to many of you regarding the treatment of non-human animals and how we go about justifying it. So the historical reasons for grounding the existence of rights on human beings tend to have centered on the following. For example, that human beings have a soul, or that human beings have a reasoning faculty, or that we have free will, and some others that I'm forgetting at the moment. But I would ask you, suppose each of those reasons fail at providing a justification for the existence of rights, as I believe they do, and we'll probably dedicate a future podcast to expanding on that proposition, but assuming they do fail, wouldn't this imply that the 10 billion or so non-human animals that we routinely slaughter every year, after having forced upon them the most miserable lives imaginable, amounts to a sort of, well, a moral emergency, perhaps coming close to mimicking some atrocity against humans that we witness somewhere on the planet every year. Of course, I'm here referring to factory farming, which kills billions of chickens, cows, pigs, and other animals annually, you know, after having subjected them to what are, by my lights, unconscionable levels of suffering in the form of their housing and feeding environments. Now, it probably shouldn't come as any surprise that this subject matter elicits very strong and unfavorable reactions from what can otherwise be entirely reasonable and calm people. You know, what is clearly at stake is the disruption of an enormous amount of inertia in the form of human comfort, the inertia of our eating habits, of what we find pleasurable and palatable, and what we enjoy participating in every day, more or less guilt-free. You know, some small change in the details that threatens this inertia, and you can be sure such details will come under heavy scrutiny. But that's not how philosophical progress works. The problem is that the habits many of us enjoy, owed to the efficiency of the modern factory farm, and thanks to the sacrifices of billions of non-human animals every year, are okay if and only if some confluence of moral and metaphysical facts exists in the right way. And if they don't, then the justification fails. So what are those facts? Well, the things we started this topic talking about. You know, that there is some difference between humans and non-humans, and within this difference lies the fact humans have certain rights which the animals lack, or that while we understand the animals to have them as well, the difference is simply so great in comparison to humans that the harm caused to the animals is overcompensated for by the benefits humans receive. Now, if you could tell by the tone of my voice, I don't think these suggestions succeed. You know, however, I don't have a simple answer here, and I'll state for the record, I eat meat and enjoy it immensely. And it's inconvenient and unfortunate the justifications for the harms have not been presented yet. And until they have, I'm living in hypocrisy and moral failure. Isn't philosophy fun? Okay, so let's entertain one last topic for this introductory podcast. Kind of piggybacked onto the last one. Suppose we suddenly agreed on this last topic and decided to change our collective behavior toward our non-human neighbors so as to avoid continuing in what we are here considering a moral outrage, that is, the inhumane treatment of non-human animals due to the factory farming techniques in place today. Now, traditionally, thinking about this implied that we would either all become vegetarian or vegan, or at the very least, transition to more humane sources of animal food products, like free-range farms and things like that. Now, even if we all suddenly became hunters, it is clear that this would be tantamount to reducing our animal consumption on a very, very large scale, you know, which begs the question, wouldn't the economic impact of such a reversal, assuming it happened in anything quicker than the most gradual of ways, you know, basically guarantee an economic depression of a potentially unprecedented kind? You know, consider how much industry is built up around the daily consumption of animals. Consider how much consumption this represents, both from the demand side but also the secondary and tertiary downward stream supporting it. You know, quite simply, eating is a huge part of our economic output, and animal eating is a huge part of that. The simple fact is our non-human neighbors represent an enormous economic value to the human population. How serious are we about our impact on these neighbors, and how much could we stomach in our quest to right the wrong? Are we willing to dramatically lower our standards of living and those of our children, not to mention the countless people in underdeveloped countries whose well-being is often tied to our economies in ways completely outside their control? How much does the harm we cause to the human species due to this major shift in our economic activity count as a balancing act against the harm we are proposing to undo, you know, by rejecting the current status quo? I don't pretend to have answers for these questions today. Frankly, I doubt I will be able to answer them in anything other than superficial ways. But my goal for today was to introduce some topics that I intend to get into later, or at least paint a picture of the kinds of things we will be talking about in this podcast. I hope you enjoyed this first episode of the Deep Further Fact podcast, and I hope you'll join me again soon.